Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. This is Mark Williams broadcasting to you from Cambridgeshire in the UK. My guest today is Simon Tarrant, the Director of Commercial Engine Lubricants for Large Engines at Lubrizol. He's been in that role since 2017 and is responsible for the long-term vision, market development strategies, advocacy, and the implementation of region-specific business plans. Simon joined Lubrizol in 2003 in product management in the driveline area of their transportation business. He spent 3 years in Asia, returning to Europe in 2010 to lead the EMEA driveline team, and then had a further 3 years as regional business director for Chemtool in the EMEA region, integrating the acquisition, and also served as Lubrizol UK ethics leader 2016-20. Prior to Lubrizol, Simon has held a variety of business and marketing management roles in both the manufacturing and services sectors, including 4 years in Saudi Arabia. He's a chartered marketer and a fellow of the Chartered Institute of Marketing and has postgraduate qualifications in marketing and supply management. Simon, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you on.
Thank you, Mark. It's lovely to be with you.
And Simon, for the benefit of those very small percentage of our listeners who aren't fully acquainted with Lubrizol, perhaps you could give us the 90-second introduction to them, please.
Certainly. So Lubrizol is a specialty chemical company, global, owned by Berkshire Hathaway. Obviously, front many will know Warren Buffett from that. And our chemistry goes into many, many products around the world. A lot of that goes into oils, into the transportation sector, but as far-reaching as going into parts of our chemistry going into the soles of Nike trainers, amongst other things.
I've just hung mine up on the washing line to dry, as it happens. But but your connection to shipping is through lubricants themselves, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of our chemical additives go into the oils that then go into the engines of the large marine ships around the world.
So Simon, in your view, what's going to drive decarbonisation in shipping? Is it the regulators? Is it commercial motives, that is the charterers? Is it finance, banks and investors? Or is it going to be suppliers like yourselves? What's the Simon take?
I think it needs all of those stakeholder elements. And perhaps the one I would add to that would be the consumers as well. Ideally, of course, all of those would be aligned through one body. And I think we all hope that that will be the International Maritime Organization. So we get a truly joined up and global strategy. If I think about regulations, those clearly have to be backed by both incentives that are going to accelerate the adoption of new technologies. But also, I think there needs to be some disincentives to help people move away from the current or existing options and help create those disincentives. And various carbon taxes have been mooted, but they will help create investment monies and also level the playing field with the new technologies that are clearly initially going to be at a higher cost until such time that they're scaled up. You mentioned commercial motives and charterers. I think commercially the shipping industry, you know, it's got to remain competitively relevant in the market. So any regulations that can help to level that playing field globally, so shipping from one region is not disadvantaged versus another, or shipping that is moving to adopt new technology isn't unfairly penalized versus people who remain on the older technologies. And I think it's also imperative that there's an understanding and an acceptance from all the consumer stakeholders that there is going to be a cost associated with achieving decarbonisation in shipping. Financially, you mentioned the banks. We appear to be going very much in the right direction with things like the Poseidon principles in banking. Overall, I think the bigger challenge here is to line up the marine industry's ambition with global and individual countries, regions. Certainly bodies like the Getting to Zero Coalition can help that. The IMO has a huge part to play, and whether we can ever reach an agreement to align with the Paris Agreement would be hugely beneficial.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens with COP26 coming up in Glasgow. You know, famously President Xi isn't going to be there, but Maritime UK will be there. And there's going to be a strong maritime theme through COP26, which is pleasing to see from the perspective of getting to zero. So it'll be good to see how the conversation develops and whether or not there are any policy announcements or regulatory announcements that come out of that.
Indeed, and I think many are hoping that the governmental pressures around the world will help the IMO to accelerate its pace on many things and get, you know, the IMO have a huge job to get all its member states heading in the right and same direction.
True enough, and I think that the emphasis on the member states is important, isn't it? I think sometimes people forget that the IMO is not a governing body, it's a parliament, and the member states through the IMO pass conventions or agree conventions, and then it's up to the member states themselves to police and enforce those conventions. The IMO doesn't have an administrative arm that performs that task globally.
Yeah, and I think that that's very important to recognise. As you say, not everybody realises that the IMO cannot just impose its will. It has to get all the member states behind it.
Right, so I wanted to come back to your point about consumers. You mentioned that consumers are important, and of course consumers could be the consumers of the fuels, it could be the consumers of shipping, the users of shipping, or it could be us, the retail consumers at the top end of the value chain. And did you see the announcement this week from the likes of Amazon and Walmart talking about decarbonizing their shipping? They've been looking at their scope 3 emissions and they want to decarbonize their shipping. I wonder what your take on that is. Is that going to be advantageous?
I think it's going to be very advantageous. You know, you mentioned Amazon, Walmart, IKEA were ahead of those two somewhat earlier, stating similar ambitions. I think it's very positive to see all aspects of consumers having an awareness of the issue, but then that conscious consumerism adding constructive pressure for the shipping industry to head on that journey to decarbonisation. For the shipping industry, I think it's also very beneficial to know that there's a true future market demand out there from their customers. You know, that gives them the confidence for the shipping industry to make the much needed investments that are going to be required for decarbonisation. Depending on who you listen to or what you read, there's various reports out there in the public domain that talk about the scale of investment required for the shipping industry to decarbonize. Mm-hmm. You know, the estimates have range from, you know, $1 trillion to $2.6 trillion, depending on whether the focus is on meeting and achieving the IMO's stated 50% emission reductions by 2050, or something even more ambitious, with complete decarbonization by 2040 or 2050, and getting to that more full and complete net zero aim.
I wonder what the likes of the retailers will do if consumers decide that they'll decarbonize consumption by consuming less. You know, you might end up with a more puritanical generation of global millennials who, you know, are having smaller families, they're having them later, they're living in smaller accommodation, you know, less square foot, they may be living in cities, they don't have large gardens. The pattern of consumption, as for instance European and American demographics show an aging population, and indeed China and Japan are showing those aging populations now, I wonder how those big retailers, big box retailers in particular, are going to react to that side of decarbonisation as well.
Indeed, and I think the assumption, of course, here is that the consumption is all based on finished product moving around the world, and you know we've heard people talk about strategies of localisation of production. So rather than have one large production facility in China, for example, and then ship products all around the world, would you have, you know, 10 or 20 optimum sized efficient manufacturing sites in places that are closer to the markets they're serving? And that's all good in theory. But of course, if you do have 20 manufacturing sites all across the world, some of the raw materials that are needed in those units need to be moved around the world. So I think, you know, you're moving one, perhaps part of the discussion here is, you know, what are you moving? Is it the finished product or is it the materials around the world to be close to those markets? But I mean, the hope, of course, is that there's an understanding across consumers that there is at least initially going to be a cost needed to be borne by us as consumers for the shipping industry to make those investments to attain a more sustainable shipping future. And ultimately, the costs of green energy, which in turn are going to enable a lot of the future options, those should reduce over time with advancing technology and as that technology is scaled up. And we've seen that happen with wind and solar power energy already.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, there's a short-term glitch in the argument with energy and electricity prices spiking at the moment and, people giving out scare stories in the UK media about brownouts here and China's, gone to close down factory production or manufacturing production because they have a shortage of coal and low inventories and haven't been able to get as much spot gas as they'd like. So, I think you're right that ultimately the cost of green energy will come down. Solar and wind have fallen 80% since the turn of the millennium. And they're now supposedly cheaper than coal, but they still require government subsidy. Interesting to note that China has been reducing its coal output over the last 2 or 3 years. But 3 years ago now, they cut their domestic subsidies for solar panels and wind. So perhaps if they hadn't, there would have been more solar panel and wind farm installations already in China. They could have had a greater renewables mix. So it comes back to the governments as well, doesn't it? The consumers will move if the governments give us the fiscal kick up the backside to make the move, which effectively means higher taxes.
Yeah, and I think I said earlier, it's getting that balance right of the incentives to bring new technology to market at the same time as potentially disincentivizing people to not change.
So how about Lubrizol? How does Lubrizol fit into this? How are you going to approach the energy transition? Do you have a sort of 10-year view of how the energy transition and Lubrizol are going to just make corporate sustainability happen positively?
Yeah, I won't comment, Mark, here on the our own footprint. There's a lot of work being done on our own facilities and how we change our own footprint for the better. But if I think about the handprint, which is what we can do with our products that enables others to make big steps forward. I said we're a specialty chemical provider, and if I focus on the marine lubricants additive part of our business, we design, develop, and then manufacture the additive systems that go into those marine lubricants or oils. And they in turn are used to ensure the safe, efficient, effective operation of the very large ship engines, particularly those large two-stroke, low-speed engines. And for those that I think many will know, but for those that don't, the scale of those engines, one of those engines is typically the size of a three-story house. And you and I, Mark, as representing a sort of normal person, we could stand up in one of the piston chambers, which is they're very big. A key part of our business is to understand how the world needs are developing and translate those market drivers and insights into the future products that are going to be required, and then ensure that our technology solutions enable those products to become a reality. In practice, what that means currently, when we look at the marine world, is how we understand the palette of new future alternate fuels that is going to be used in the coming decades in the shipping sector, and what new additive lubricant solutions they will need to ensure that those fuels can be used in those ship engines. The timeline for us to go from take that initial market insight data and translate it into what we think the needs are, and go from laboratory research through to formulating new chemistry technologies, conducting mechanical tests. So, we put those oils into engines. We learn more when something breaks. We break pistons, we break piston rings. So we learn what's causing the failures. And then we prove the performance, and then take a product to market. That can take 3 to 5 years. So we can't wait until those future alternate fuels are scaled up and in the market. We've got to take action now.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? That sort of 5-year development process. I saw a quote from Wärtsilä saying they've got designs, for instance, for ammonia engines and dual fuel ammonia engines that they could fit into, for instance, LPG tankers now, because it's very similar technology. but it'll probably be 2025 before they build anything. How much do you have to work with the engine manufacturers to understand the lubrication needs for internal combustion engines using alternative fuels like liquefied ammonia or other hydrogen carriers?
Our customers are the lubricant suppliers who provide the marine engine oils that go into the, that go to the ship owner operators and the vessel fleet around the world. In addition to working closely with our customers, we also engage with those marine engine designers and manufacturers to ensure that anything that we're doing on the additive lubricant front, the performance aligns with how those engines, the engines and the engine technology is being evolved to, as they look to provide greater efficiencies. You know, they're looking to provide greater efficiencies and improve the energy footprints, and also how that engine technology is and needs to be adapted to operate with those alternate fuels. So we each have our fields of expertise, the oil marketers, the additive companies, the OEMs. We need to link up and connect together to bring those three sets of expertise to the same point.
In broad terms, think about the where your products fit into that marine engineering element of the vessel design. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, absolutely. So in broad terms, the key performances that you require from marine engine lubricant and a two-stroke, taking a two-stroke cylinder lubricant as an example, the lubricant clearly and obviously lubricates the moving parts, but it also needs to neutralize acids that are formed in the combustion cycle of those current traditional diesel fuels. And then it's looking to keep the piston and the piston rings clean, which in turn minimizes deposits that could cause detrimental wear and ultimately failure within the engine. And let me go a stage further and give you an outline of the approach that we're taking when we're looking at alternate fuels. We see it as a four-step understanding process. Firstly, are there any distinct new or different inherent characteristics of these alternate fuels? Secondly, what might the OEMs need to adapt in their engine hardware to accommodate those fuels? And that could be the metallurgies of the parts they use, certain coatings on metals, the fuel injection and combustion control systems, and other parts, fundamental parts of the engine design and operation.
Yeah.
Thirdly, combustion. What happens when the fuel goes in the engine and goes bang and creates the power? What new or different combustion phenomena might we see with those alternate fuels in tandem with the lubricant? So today, you know, one of the things I mentioned was the acidic nature of the combustion. And in the future, it still could be acidic in nature, but it might be different. So it could be a nitric acid rather than what we see today. Or are there going to be new chemistry compositions as part of that combustion cycle? An example here could be phosphoramides. And then that brings us to our fourth point, which is, well, how will the additive and lubricant chemistry need to be enhanced to continue to deliver those required performances with those new fuels? And that's the challenge that we're looking at right now.
How do you go about that with alternative fuels where the technology is still developing? You know, if you look at ammonia, we're at the very early stages of designing ammonia powered engines. So how do you get around that?
So there is no getting around it as such. We engage with, say, the OEMs, but we also engage with academia on our own R&D to create simulations that are ahead of market scale up and give you a couple of examples of where we think the lubricants are going to need enhanced chemistry in the future. Take ammonia, as you know, you've mentioned as an example. It's inherently more corrosive by nature, and many people may not realize, but ammonia is not going to be readily compatible with a lot of the traditional additive chemistries that are deployed with current lubricant solutions. Another example would be, you know, gas fuels. So today, the shipping industry largely uses liquid diesel fuels. When you look at combusting a gas fuel, those have a tendency to be directionally higher in combustion temperatures, which requires the lubricant to have a greater thermal strength. Otherwise, the oil would degrade a lot faster, and it wouldn't have the ability to keep providing those protection performances that it needs to give.
It's interesting, isn't it? We spend a lot of time talking about alternative marine fuels, but we have to spend an equal amount of time and attention on all the chemistry that goes around those marine fuels and those new engines for things like the additives and lubricants to make sure that the engineering runs smoothly over the life cycle, just as we do today with the diesel fuels and the hydrocarbons.
Yeah, I don't think it's immediately obvious or realised that the lubricant is an inherent part of the whole design process, along with anything that you change in the engine to, you know, make it more efficient or enable the use of a cleaner fuel. And that's where we are busy in the background, connecting those dots, bringing new additives to market that will enable those alternate fuels. It's exciting. It's an exciting challenge for our team. We're very focused on delivering the solutions. We've brought some very recent technology to market to help with the new IMO 2020 fuels, and we're going to continue. We're going to continue enabling shipping's journey to decarbonisation.
It's good to hear, Simon. If people want to find out more, what's the website that they could go to find out more about what you're doing?
If people go to the lubrizol.com website, they will find a part of that website called 360, which is where we're trying to replay 360 degree views back to the market, and they can also look up myself on and the Lubrizol Additives and Lubrizol Corporation on LinkedIn.
Okay, great. So that's 360.lubrizol.com.
Yes.
And Simon Tarrant is in LinkedIn. And I just want to finish off. I know you're I think we've got a minute left on our allotted time. I know you're a keen biker. Do you think one day you'll ever be riding a hydrogen or ammonia powered bike?
I hope so. I hope I live both long enough to continue to ride, and certainly those new technologies are definitely coming.
Would you think it's more likely to be ultra fast, electric, massive torque bike that you'll be on?
I think an electric bike in the short term. I've moved away from the sports bikes and more to the off road bikes these days, and some of the electric technology in the off road bikes is already very much there.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's a small-scale transport, easy to electrify. Large-scale transport, like shipping, we have to think again. So it's good to know that organisations like Lubrizol are very much part of that conversation.
Yes, deep-sea shipping is one of those hard-to-abate sectors, and that's why the alternate fuels is very much the preferred solution going forward, because battery electric technology for deep-sea shipping just isn't. I don't think anybody can see past the two-stroke internal combustion engine with a cleaner fuel over the next 20, 30 years.
It seems to be very much the way things are going at the moment. Well, listen, Simon, thank you so much for coming on to join us today. It's an interesting lens through which to view the decarbonisation discussion, because it's one that we don't often think about. So it's great to get that perspective from you today. So thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Mark. Yes, as I said, we're very busy squirreling away in the background, and it's nice to be allowed to be in front of that lens, albeit an audio one today.
Well, it's good to open the window onto your world, even briefly. Thanks very much for that. And thank you to everyone out there in listener land. And we look forward to bringing you another Ship Energy podcast very soon. So thanks for now, and goodbye, and enjoy the rest of your week.